describing three of the fundamental interactions. And then you have the Poincaré group describing gravity. And people wrote down a gauge theory of the Poincaré group and they understood these as gauge theories. So what they were looking for, there are grand unified theories called gut, where what you look for is some group G that contains those three. And then you have toes, theory of everything, that where you look for a group that contains so you have a group that contains all four of these in some way. Well, all right, the Coleman-Mandula theorem says, okay, a sensible quantum field theory has, you know, these properties, and, you know, they list four or five properties that they argue a sensible quantum field theory should have, and, you know, four of the five are sensible, and one is some funny condition that, you know, could certainly be true, or, you know, seems right. And then their theorem is that any unification, you know, basically a toe, that is also a sensible quantum field theory. That is satisfied by these. Is of the form big G has to be the direct product of Poincaré cross some unifying symmetry here. It has to be a direct product. Okay, and that means there's no unification at all. If we want to look at, what's a good example? Say we take SU5 as G, and the generators of SU5, so 5x5 unitary matrices. Up in this corner, we've got some 3x3s. Those can be the generators of an SU. Those are the generators of an SU3. So we've got our SU3 inside there. And then down here in this corner, those guys can generate SU2. So we've got our SU2 in SU5. And then there's one matrix where we have 1, 1, 1, and minus, 3 halves here, minus 3 halves. But so down here is the multiple of the identity, minus 3 halves. Up here is the identity. So this commutes with that, and it commutes with that. So that's a single generator that can generate the U1. So your U1 generator looks like that one. And so these guys are the SU2 generators don't include the identity, so this isn't one of those. And the SU3 don't include the identity, so this part isn't one of those. So this is independent of those two. So SU5 contains the direct product of all three groups. Now the interesting thing about unification is the stuff that's not in one of those groups, the stuff that lies up here and down there. Alright, here you've got some X particles and some Y particles. And if this group governs You know, if this is really the group in 7 hours, now you've got a prediction, because you're predicting that these particles actually do something. They're going to interact the way the rest of this stuff does. Well, what these do is those particles can act, you know, these, you've got three quarks and then you've got two leptons. So these are the things that those generators act on. And if you look at what happens, if you multiply this out, you know, if you look at like a sidebar and, you know, one of these generators and a psi kind of thing where, you know, your psi looks like that, it's going to include terms where you have a quark field from, you know, over here, sidebar. So the first three elements here are going to combine with an X and a lepton. So you have an interaction where a lepton comes along, emits an X particle, and turns into a quark. Or vice versa, more likely the other way, because the quarks are heavier. So you have a quark going along, emitting an X particle, and turning into a lepton. All right, this is a new interaction. You know, we've never seen this interaction in the laboratory. It's a prediction of this theory. So you've, on the one hand, you've come up with a nice, unified, simple mathematical form for the general theory that is based on a simple group rather than a direct product. So mathematically, this is more elegant. And you've made some precise new predictions. Well, what this means is that if you've got, say, a down quark coming along and emits an X particle, then suddenly a lepton goes spinning off and, you know, you've got a pair of quarks over here. Well, those quarks will probably, let's see, what's it going to do? I'm not sure what happens to these two. You know, they probably, let's see. Yeah, you might want to emit another one. This goes into some black box here. Turns into something else. The point is that whatever those do is no longer a proton, right? It's become, you know, probably some mesons, you know, maybe ions or whatever, and an electron or something, right? A positron, something like that. The proton has decayed. So these particles, the X's and the Y's, they're called leftover quarks. This theory predicts that the proton should decay, and if you work out the decay rate, like we've just been learning how to do, the decay rate says that the half-life of the proton ought to be something like, if you just use this theory, as I'm presenting it here, 10 to the 32 years. Well, that's a long half-life, so protons are fairly stable. That seems okay. But if you can get 10 to the 32 protons all in one place and watch them for a year, you'll see one decay. And we don't. That's been done. And the half-life of a proton, you know, if it's not absolutely stable, the half-life is longer than that. So actually, this theory, as first formulated, you know, there are modifications of the theory that might be okay, actually. But as first formulated, this theory doesn't work. It predicts things that don't happen. But this is the type of thing you'd like to do. You'd like to come up with a simple group that contains this product, make some predictions from it, go test those predictions, and say, hey, you know, this works better. This allows me to understand three different fundamental interactions of nature as one kind of interaction. There's just this one interaction. And it breaks into different parts, you know, depending on what we're looking at, but it's really one thing. Well, Coleman and Mangula said, oh, well, if you want to do this for gravity, you put your unification group, you know, say SU5 up here, and you knuckle your Poincaré group down there, you've got to have zeros here. That's their conclusion. Any group that contains both Poincaré and some unitary unification is necessarily only a direct product. You don't get any unification. And this was true for any Lie algebra. You know, they created it for any Lie algebra. Well, supersymmetry groups don't satisfy a Lie algebra. You have anti-commutation relations of the generators along with the commutation relations. So it gets around the Coleman-Mandula theorem. You can have a non-trivial symmetry, not a Lie group symmetry, but a graded Lie group symmetry that contains the Poincaré group non-trivially. So supersymmetry allows you to do that. So supersymmetry is the, really maybe the only way out of the Coleman-Mandula theorem, unless you can, possibly you might violate one of these assumptions here. But like I say, at least, three out of four out of five of them, I forget whether there are four or five of those assumptions are, it would be very hard to imagine a field theory that didn't satisfy those assumptions. That's the thing.
Do you know who first made this Lefkoe quark prediction?
Oh, the MQ5 model? All these papers from the late 70s. There were hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of papers proposing unified models, grand unified theories. A great deal of the physics of the 1970s, once people realized the standard model was this simple picture, the product of these three unitary groups, people immediately started writing down, what groups can contain that? E6 contains it very nicely. SL-348 also contains it very nicely. There are a lot of ways to contain this. You'd like it to be small. This is the most compact one. And so it's going to be the most predictive. You'd like something small. Well, of course, string theory ends up with E8 cross E8, which is huge. Or SO32 cross SO32. Those two groups are, I think, the same size. But SO32 has, 16 times 33 times 2. It's got 1,000 generators or something. It's an immense group. There's got to be some symmetry breaking. There are various ways of breaking symmetries, but if you have to break 900 generators down to 1, 2, 3, 4, plus 8 to 12, there are going to be a lot of different ways to do it. So it's not going to be very predictive. And this is one of the problems with string theory, finding a systematic, sensible, motivated way to break this very large symmetry group and get to something that has the known properties of the standard model. You know, a huge amount of known about exactly the nature of these things. And you'd like to get right to that predictively. But how do you do it when you're starting with these huge symmetry groups?
Not so clear.
There is good work being done to narrow it down. Systematic work looking at possible ways of compactifying these 10-dimensional spaces down to 4-dimensional spaces with some residual symmetry. If you look at broad classes of groups, broad classes of spaces, Lie-out spaces, this sort of thing, are a very nice, very large class that would account for a lot of the possible compactifications of 6 dimensions. Maybe give you a route to some sensible models. And people are working kind of from both ends on it. So, supersymmetry lets you escape this symmetry. a supersymmetry group contains the Poincaré group non-trivially. What happens?
How does Stanion feed into this?
Well, the Octonians have a property that's required for supersymmetry. One condition you need in order to have supersymmetry is a balance between the number of fermions and the number of bosons. And it turns out that that has to do with the gamma matrices, the Dirac matrices, which get big in higher dimensions. Okay, in n dimensions, the Dirac matrices. So suppose you want to do a 10-dimensional Dirac theory in 10 dimensions. Right. So, how many components does the spinner have? Well, the spinner has 2 to the dimension over 2 degrees of freedom. So, this is 2 to the 5th, it's 32 component spinners. Right. So, in space-time, we deal with 4 component spinners. Well, when you go to 10 dimensions, it goes up fast. It goes up exponentially. And the problem is that the number of bosonic fields you can write goes up algebraically, goes like n squared or something. So you can't maintain a match between the number of degrees of freedom of spinners and the number of degrees of freedom of the bosonic field that you need to have supersymmetry, unless there's a certain property that guarantees that these degrees of freedom match the bosonic ones. Well, it turns out that the condition you need it can be cast in the form of a product law that is exactly the product law for a division, a norm division algebra. The norm of x times y is the norm of x times the norm of y. This is true for any division algebra, and it's not true for anything else. And that's exactly the condition that you need when you write it in terms of gamma matrices. So you have a Clifford algebra, but the Clifford algebra can only be a division algebra in certain low dimensions. So you find that, 10, 6, 3 in one dimension, I think, you can have supersymmetry in not many other dimensions. It really hinges on this property of division algebras, when you can get the numbers to match.
Cool.
Next question.
So symmetric groups don't have a normally algebra then?
No. You have anti-commutation relations. So maybe we can construct a simple supersymmetry. Okay, so you have transformations. Suppose we have an action with a scalar field. Let's suppose we have several scalar fields. So sum on I here, c mu y. Now let's see, what defines the Klein-Gordon equation? Minus 5 squared. Give or take a sign. And then we've got some Dirac fields. So let's just take one Dirac field. Phi bar I d slash minus sine. And let's count degrees of freedom. Let's see, can we do this with a you know, we might be able to do this easier with, yeah, in two dimensions, you'd have a two-component spinner instead of complex scalar field would do it. Let's see, so what would the, what the, would the equivalent Dirac equation be if we demanded it be with the Pauli spinners? I forget what the Dirac equation looks like, you know, for one Pauli spinner. Let's see. Alternatively, if we were to go higher, you know, we could add a vector particle, like the vector potential for E and M. Let's look at this and see if we can get this to work. I'm not sure if we can. My I squared. So we have several of these scalar fields. I don't know if we can make this work or not. But the idea is this: you have a transformation that is, you know, you've got a new phi under an old phi, and it depends on the spinner field. So the transformation that leaves this action invariant is going to be something that adds a certain something to the proportional to the spinner field to the scalar field. Well, that's fine, except the spinner field anti-commutes, and these things have to commute, right? How can we make something commuting from an anti-commuting thing? Well, this parameter has to be anti-commuting as well. So if you introduce an anti-commuting parameter in your group transformation, that'll let you do this. And then the change in phi is going to be something that depends on phi. So you're going to need something like you know, epsilon I phi I would do it, something like that. And then you have to adjust between these two actions so that all these terms drop out, so that the variation of the action is zero. Well, it turns out you can do it. So you can make this work. But these parameters, right, you've got a scalar times, this has to be a spinner type thing in order to get a spinner. So it's, you know, that parameter of the group has to be anti-commuting. Well, normally, if we've got a realgebra, looks like FU2. Right? We know that the commutation relations of FU2 can be satisfied by the Pauli matrices. So we've got, what is here, 2i, epsilon i, j, k, sigma k, something like that. And if we look at the infinitesimal generators of this group, well, the infinitesimal generators are these fermionic things. So they're going to satisfy something anti-commuting. We've got a bunch of them. We're going to have some epsilon I and some epsilon j need to be something. Well, it turns out that what they need to be is, see what would work here. How many do we need? If we've got 4 degrees of freedom in psi, then we need maybe 4 scalar fields, something like that. We could make them complex. That match. But let's see. Oh, okay. So there's a bosonic symmetry here. If I take phi tilde to be just a regular rotation of phi, right? That's just an orthogonal group or a unitary group, one or the other. So these would be unitary or orthogonal matrices. And the generators of these, for that group, would, depending how many we had, we might be able to write it as something like, now we would have more. It depends on how many of these there are. the thing we have to get here is some structure known to CIJ, and then what you usually get. It's actually a translation here. I should probably actually look up an example of this and show you guys. This is good. The one that actually occurs. Okay, the point is you've got an anti-commutation relation here. You know, this is going to be something kind of, you know, maybe it's going to be like an L with a Pauli matrix, something like that. But, you know, two of these is going to be bosonic, so you're going to get back to these generators. So the two linked up non-trivially. You know, that's what happens. Here's an actual supersymmetry algebra. If we work with two components together, then the supersymmetry generators, there's a Q and it has a conjugate Q bar A dot. So A and A dot run from 1 to 2. This is when we write war vectors as bispinners. So you call this a DV dot. So you're replacing one space-time index with a pair here using the Pauli matrix. So you're writing in spinner language. These act on spinners, but what happens is that the anti-commutator of Q and Q bar is 2i times Pauli matrix sigma mu a dot. So you match those indices, and this is a translation generator. So the supersymmetry transformation that is actually mixing up the spins of the field is going to give you a translation generator. So it's coupling into the Poincaré group. But the fact is, it's an anti-commutator escapes the consequences of the Coleman-Mandula theorem. So what these Qs are? These Qs are infinitesimal generators. So the change in some scalar field, let's say, is going to be some fermionic parameter times this generator Q. I don't know why the generators are called Q. You know, they are. Acting on your I should be acting on some spinner. So I'm acting on your spinner field time, and then the change in time is going to be these things acting on phi. So this is some kind of operator. You can actually write these operators as something like d theta a minus you need a regular space time derivative here, so probably theta bar b dot Pauli matrix u a b dot. So something like this, where the thetas are anti-commutative numbers. These are coordinates in superspace. So we build a space that now has x, y, z, and t, and for anti-commuting coordinates. And sometimes you can represent supersymmetry this way, but then This looks like it might almost satisfy that. There's probably an I in here somewhere. Let's suppose we've got an I here. Then if I take Q R A dot with Q A, what is that? That's D D theta A minus I theta bar B dot sigma A B dot U. That, acting on Q bar, which is going to be something like BD theta bar A dot, plus I'm not sure what happens to the inside, but theta B sigma U. And you know, all of this is acting on some field. Plus, you know, do it the other way to get the anti-commutator. So, let's see, this gives me a Kronecker VA. So I have something like I sigma mu a dot du when this hits that thing. And then when we add it in the other direction, we're going to have this thing differentiating that one and giving us a similar thing. The only trick here is that the anti-commutation gives us another sign and gets us to. I forget how that works. I suppose the logical next semester for us is Wes and Bagger. Work through a supersymmetry book. The supersymmetry is probably important. It really has some very nice properties. I think the most impressive property is that there exists finite supersymmetric field theories, right? The infinities that we've had to renormalize away, they're actually exist supersymmetric field theories where no renormalization is required. Things just all come out right. What happens is the things that would have diverged always have some matching supersymmetrically related Feynman diagram that comes in with exactly the opposite sign and cancels them off. So the supersymmetric theories converge better. They're really the only known route to a total unification. And they give a systematic way of introducing fermions into an otherwise bosonic theory. So you have some bosonic theory that you think describes, say, gravity. You can supersymmetrize it, and now it'll describe particle fields, too. Another indication of supersymmetry comes from a study of Rarita-Schwinger fields. Rarita-Schwinger fields are spin 3/2 fields. Okay, so you know about Taylor fields, and we've talked about Dirac fields, spin half. Vector fields like the electromagnetic potential or the gauge fields of Fu2 or Fu3, the gluons and the WSB particles. You know, the graviton is a spin 2 field, right? It's got two Lorentz indices. So when you do this, it's going to have four spin 1/2 indices. 4 times spin 1/2 is spin 2. So general relativity relies on a spin 2 field. Well, are there any spin 3/2 fields? What happened to them? So Rarita and Schwinger wrote down a field equation akin to the Dirac equation for a spin 3/2 field. And it's a little funny because it implies a seemingly unnecessary constraint on the curvature when you commute these things. There's this curvature condition that has to be satisfied or the Rarita-Schwinger field is not consistent. I forget what the constraint is, but then Desder and I forget who, Desder and somebody showed that the if you look at a if you look at general relativity and try to derive a spin free Hab field by taking a square root of the Einstein equation the way Dirac took the square root of the Klein-Gordon equation, you get a spin free Hab field, and it's supersymmetrically related to the metric, the spin 2 field. So it builds a supersymmetric system, and that curvature condition is automatically satisfied. So it works exactly right for the spin 2, spin 3 half system. You know, it gives you all of the conditions you need for that whole thing to even work at all. So those things, you know, the successful treatment of the spin 3 half field, the finite quantum field theory, the potential for non-trivially unifying gravity with the other interactions, I think these are the strongest arguments I can give for why we should pay real attention to supersymmetry. It gives us a lot of consistency. You know, since I read Wessenbagger, I've been of a mind that whatever theory you come up with, you probably ought to supersymmetrize it. Take a look at that. The right version. We've done it for biconformal space. We supersymmetrized, looked at the superconformal group and gauged it. If you've ever seen that set of equations up in the right hand corner of my board in my office, that's a superconformal gauge theory. There are a lot of fields in supersymmetric theories. They really multiply. Your pen needs to last about 8 times as long just to get through the problem.
Does that does that group contain standard gauge groups from SU3, SU2, etc.?
Yeah, it can.
Okay.
It can.
Okay.
What happens when you supersymmetrize? So you've got you start with a supersymmetric transformation matrix. You've got some normal bosonic B group up here, and then you've got another normal bosonic B group down there, and then the fermionic part by the off diagonal thing. Well, you need a spinner representation of these so that this is comprised of spinner type thing. So what happens is, if you do, say, the conformal group up here, then what needs to go down here is FUN for some n. There are probably limits on how big n can be. So, for example, I'm not sure it can be as big as 5. But
what group did you use when you used?
We did it for general n.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. We just wrote it down. There are some constraints within supersymmetry, though, because if you have too many supersymmetric fields, you know, suppose you have a lot of supersymmetries, then you've got a lot of supersymmetric fields. And what you can do is use them to build, you can build higher and higher spin. Right, let me try to think of the simplest way to show you how this works. If you introduce an anti-commuting coordinate, suppose you can do a superspace formulation. So you're going to introduce some kind of a theta coordinate for each independent supersymmetry. Well, you can use these to build more and more complicated fields. So, for example, if you look at a what's called a scalar superfield, all right, that's a scalar field that depends on your x coordinates, and for four x coordinates, you're going to want two thetas and two theta bars. So it'll be a function of eight coordinates, four of which anti-commute. Well, think that anti-commute, suppose I take, you know, theta A is just a, you know, there's a theta 1 and a theta 2. A run deal 1 and 2. Well, suppose I multiply theta 1 times theta 1, what's that equal?
Zero.
Yeah, that's zero. Say anti-commute. Theta 1, theta 2 is minus theta 2, theta 1.
Right.
So you have to be very careful what words you write there. And theta 2 squared is the zero. Well, this is death on Taylor theory. You can only take so many powers of things before everything is, you know, some theta has gotten squared. So if you expand scalar superfield in a Taylor series, how many things can it get? Well, not so many. You can have a scalar field, and then at next order, you can have the derivative of this with respect to theta, you know, gives some coefficient that's going to have an A index on it. So let's call it a chi A theta A, and we could have a psi bar A dot theta bar A dot. So these are just the coefficients in the Taylor series, but then these remain functions of X only. So these are normal space-time fields, just expanded out in these theta coordinates. Well, and then if we take two derivatives, there's a thing in a two-dimensional space, you've got a two-dimensional but a pivot tensor. It's anti-symmetric, so I can form theta A, theta B, and basically, half of that is theta 1, theta 2. So something quadratic in the thetas can always be written as this thing, and that thing is just defined to be theta squared. That's what you mean by theta squared. So that's like the metric on the theta. You need an anti-symmetric metric for anti-commuting numbers. Anti-commuting numbers is a funky idea. Okay.
Do these theta depend on X as well?
No, they're independent coordinates.
Okay.
Yeah, you've got four normal directions and four super directions, the fermionic directions. So at the next order, we get three terms. We're going to have we can have something that goes like theta squared. So we can have a lambda field, that'd be a scalar with a theta squared, and we can have a tau of x with a theta bar squared. And then for the theta dot, we can make more combinations there. You actually can have a vector field with an A B dot, and then you have a theta A and a theta bar B dot for the cross term. So you actually get 4 degrees of freedom here. Well, there's your vector potential. And then you go to next order, and you're going to have some more spinners. You're going to have what's a nice name for some spinners? Let's say A of X with a theta A and a theta bar squared, and you could have a theta A of X dot bar with a theta bar A dot theta squared, and then finally one more scalar field. And the sigma of x, say, with the theta squared, theta r squared, like that. And that's the end of the Taylor series. Anything else is going to have five anti-commuting things of which you only have four different ones, and it will be zero. So that's the full Taylor series for the scalar superfield in the theta coordinates. Each coefficient remains a field on space-time. And these fields make up what's called a supermultiply. So these are the fields that shuffle into one another under a supersymmetric transformation. Well, the supersymmetric transformations now amount to coordinate transformations. So you do a lot of coordinate transformations among these eight coordinates, and those actually generate all of the supersymmetry transformations of these supermultiplet fields. I think that it's possible to take, you know, if this is a real field, you probably want some properties like, you know, phi, you know, phi bar, you know, could actually be tied to conjugate. So, you know, you only get one here. You could do a similar thing with these two. Those two could be conjugate to one another. So then if you conjugate the whole thing, the field turns into itself. So the simplest case is a real superfield. And you'll have pure fields. So the multiplet, you'll have a scalar field, you have a spinner field, you might have a couple of scalar fields. Let's see, that one real, but this one complex. So lambda, lambda, star. Then you have a vector field, and then you've got another spinner field, psi, its conjugate, and then the sigma is another real field. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, and 4 for the vector is 8 real bosonic fields, and then we have 2 complex spinners, 2 component spinners. So that's 8 numbers as well. So we have the same number of fields. We have a balance of the numbers of fields. And it turns out you can do supersymmetry transformations that actually remove some of these degrees of freedom. And you can just trim it down by some pieces can be transformed away, but not all of them. That's wild stuff. Pretty cool technology. I've worked on it. It sort of fits and starts. Worked through some of it early on, and then when we supersymmetrized the bisonformal group, I spent a couple of years, you know, remembering how to do supersymmetry. And it's fun. It's challenging because, you know, where you might have had one scalar field before, now look at all the fields you've got. Well, if you try to write an action for this thing, expand it out in terms of all, you've got a lot of fields. So it turns out to show you the problem you can run into if you've got too many scalar fields. Back here, you've got some unifying thing. You let this SUN be big, and you've got a whole bunch of fermionic fields here. Well, if you take two fermionic fields, phi A, chi B, okay, you know, this is from bosonic field. What do you call bosonic field? You know, phi A B. Okay, well, that's a spin one field. Let's make one of them a bar. So that dot, and you could put a poly matrix on there. A B dot. Now with phi B dot. That's some measure field. Well, if you've got 4 different spinner fields around, you can go higher. So you can take psi A and chi or B dot and psi and beta or d dot. And you can put a couple of Pauli matrices on here, mu and sigma d d dot mu, and you know that sums into a field. Well, if you've got another one or two, say you have six, you could come up with a spin tree field. We don't know any spin tree fields. I mean, there couldn't be some. It's actually very hard to make consistent spin tree field theory. People don't generally know a way to do it without adding any spin, which you could do. But the rule of thumb is to stop when you've got enough independent spinner fields that you don't get any higher than spin 2. And you only want to get one of those because there's only one graviton in the yellow host. And that limits how big you can choose that unitary symmetry. But then you can do these things in higher dimensions, right? So, let's see. And, you know, that bosonic group, you know, if you chose, say, the six-dimensional conformal group instead of the four-dimensional conformal group, okay, we had 15 generators in four dimensions. Now it's, let's see, for six, it's going to be n plus 1, n plus 2, so 7 times 8 over 2 is like 28 dimensional conformal groups. You have a lot of symmetry left over inside of that. So you take some subgroup, the 15-dimensional group, you do gravity with that, and now you've got some extra symmetry up in that D vector, too. So that's another way to get more symmetry into it if you want.
Did you do the four-dimensional group instead of the two?
We did four, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it turns out you need to pretty much pick one. We started out trying to do it in an arbitrary number of dimensions, because, of course, there aren't supersymmetry groups in an arbitrary number of dimensions. And really need to develop some dimension-specific notation to be able to work with it and, you know, write an action. So we wanted to take the quotient here, right? We want to take the quotient with C by the bottom group in order to get by conformal space. And so we needed to find a supersymmetric extension of the vial group so we could take a quotient by the supersymmetric extension. Well, it turned out that it was essentially unique, which was really nice. So there was really only one way to extend the biconformal quotient of C by the vial group, conformal by vial, to superconformal mod supervial. It really worked out nicely. Other questions? You do this all day? Or have we? Did we do some U1 stuff, or do you want to do another QED calculation? Oh, by the way, the calculation we did on Monday, I typed up in its entirety, corrected the mistake I made with the energy, but there's an obvious observation. T is E and 3 vector T, and T prime was E and minus T. So S, which is the square of T plus T prime, is much easier to compute than what we did. Okay, add them first, so you have 2 E and 0. And so the square of that is just 4 E squared. We had some other things by mistake.
Oh.
So that simplifies things. And so correcting that, there might have been some other factor or two or something different from what we did on the board. But we were basically on target. And all of that, I wrote it all up, linked the PDF disk, and there's a PDF online now that has that whole calculation written out carefully. So you can check that and go over it at your leisure. So, as I was saying, we could do another, right? We could, we could do electron muon scattering. say, which would be very similar, but it seems to me that that should look a little bit like Rutherford scattering in some approximation. You know, if we, or say we did electron-proton scattering, we'll have a mass of the proton in there, and if we let the mass of the proton become infinite, it ought to reduce the Coulomb scattering that we showed the other day. So it might be fun to work through something like that. Or we could continue our discussion of the U1 theory in biconformal space. What do you guys feel like? I'll put it to a vote. If it's 2-2, I'll cast it back to it. I won't move until the vote tally is up. Got a preference?
I think U1. That's my vote.
There's a vote for U1.
No, biconformal U1.
Yeah.
Or, okay.
I confirm the U1. Huh?
Well, I guess that's good with U1, I guess.
We're out of voting.
Yeah,
mine has two. We could tie it up.
All right.
Okay. Let's take a look at biconformal U1.
I think we left out the dual right, last time. Yeah.
We were talking about how to take the dual.
Right, right.
That's right. Seems like we had just started that. Did we finish talking about the dual or just get going on it? Do you remember what we got to? Does anybody have any idea what we've done up to now?
I know you were just talking about it like last time. Describing the differences between that one and the regular.
He fell off the board with the dual. Yeah,
yeah.
I remember that part.
Yeah, I remember I was over on the side of them.
You were describing the differences between the Leibniz dual and the
So the Hobby dual, let's just recap and a form omega A through B X A which is B. So let's suppose we have C of these in D dimensions. D less than or equal to D. Then the Hodge dual, usually denoted by an asterisk, we take the coefficients, we raise them with copies of the metric, we put a heavy unit tensor, so let's let this be the anti-symmetric symbol, and I'll put the root G's in explicitly, C through D, well that's T indices, so we still have N minus P, E through F, and we put those on the basis points. And then, since there are N minus P of those, we divide by N minus P factorial, and that keeps the nice normalization to things. So, those are my conventions for the Hodge dual. The symplectic dual I denote with a star. It's harder to draw stars. And it's really tricky in play actually. There's a big star. If you type small and then make a star that's a little smaller, but it's still pretty big.
You go to Control H and take the star. Right?
Control H.
Or whatever the superscript.
Yeah, okay. I use Control J. So I make a superscript. But then if I type backslash small and do a star in the superscript, it makes it even smaller.
Oh, okay. So you can change the size, okay.
Yeah. Oh. So yeah, there is a way that, you know, they have a thing called tiny, but I couldn't get it to work.
Oh.
I'll try backslash tiny and see what happens.
To put backslash tiny and then backslash star or something, or? Or is it just one command?
I don't know. I just type backslash small and, you know, put it in the star.
From the drop-down menu.
It seems like it might be smaller than what it was before. I still have to play with it. Anyway, we take the syntactic dual, and the only difference, we still have the same factors, the same rule here. We take the coefficients of the original thing, but now we use the simplistic form instead of the metric. And the, in general, you would still use the Levy cubic tensor, but we'll talk about that in a second. There's something special that happens in biconformal space. So you end up with a similar sort of thing here, only the dependence on the metric is different, since the metric is one of your gauge fields, right? We want to gauge the conformal or the Poincaré group, something like that. The presence of that root G and of these G's is going to affect the field equation for gravity. It's going to be something different because of this. And yeah, I think I spent some time talking about, you know, what happens if you take a curvature star curvature action, like a normal Yang-Mills type action for gravity. It's got all this stuff in it, and you end up with this curvature squared source for the Einstein equation, which is pretty messy. Or not the Einstein equation, the divergence of the curvature is equal to some curvature quadratic stuff. But now, more happens in biconformal space. Our basis, which I've been writing here as, VX's, but, you know, you can also do this with an orthonormal basis. You could have orthonormal forms here if you want. Do the same here. So you can do it either way. If you have orthonormal ones, then you need the you would want the orthonormal
data
or study test, and for the orthonormal case that root would be 1. In biconformal space, it doesn't matter what it is because your basis forms, your proper form is really one of a pair. You have an omega A up and an omega A down, a solder and a cosolder form. Or your DXA is a pair. You've got a DXA up and a DY index down, like this. There's different distinct types. And these are distinguishable. The conformal weights of these are opposite. Because of the index position, the Lorentz transformation properties or transformations are opposite. So what this means is that the Levy Fiesta tensor is so we've got A, B, C, D. All right, let's specialize the four dimensions. Just so things are a little clearer, FGH. And what is this? Well, half of these have to be up and half has to be down. So what you're going to get is this is the magnitude of the determinant of, let me write the full biconformal metric, is some capital G. But then you know, a typical instance where you've got various things summed in various ways, you're going to have, you know, an A and a B down and a C up and a D down and an E, F, G, and an H, maybe. Something like that. And what we can do is agree to always rearrange these things so the up ones are first and the down ones are second. So there's an ordering here. Well, so this is going to be C, E, F, G, A, B, D, H. But now, let's see, I move C past two things. I move E, F, G past three things. That gives me a minus sign. So I pick up a minus sign. So you've got to be very careful with signs when you rearrange these things. But the rules stay the same. The rules are you write the coefficient, you write the either symplectic or metric quadratic form, and sum these, the indices of the coefficient, you sum in order on those things. Then the three indices here are summed on the first indices, the first p indices of the Levi Civita, and then these are summed in the same order as the coordinates.
What is this capital, square root of capital G? Is that the kilometric?
Like informal metric.
Oh, okay.
In general. All right, if we were in the orthonormal frame, it would be 1, 1, right, as, you know, chronic or chronicer.
Right.
Something like this and zeros here. If, you know, that's the killing metric. If we had, if we were in the coordinate basis, then you actually pick up an H,
H minus
one
H.
Of the other places.
Right. Right.
Now it's either an H inverse here or an H there. So, you know, one form of it looks like this. In those coordinates. Then in the UV coordinates, it turns out to be block diagonal, which is really the point, AB in minus
H should be, okay.
AB inverse and zeros here. Right, so we've seen these various possibilities. The next thing that happens is, and this certainly happens in the G tilde tilde case where we have the block diagonal form of the metric. Those subspaces are chosen to be submanifolds. And those submanifolds have their own Levi-Civita tensor. So, epsilon A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. So in the UV coordinates, I'll make this plain for sure. This is probably the case in other coordinates as well. Since it factors in one coordinate system, the manifold structure is invariant. So these manifolds exist regardless. The coordinates may, you know, the coordinate expression for the submanifolds is U and V. I'm trying to choose, so that if I hold U constant, I'm on a submanifold spanned by V. If I hold V constant, I'm on an orthogonal submanifold spanned by U. And there seems to be a mistake in that paper somewhere, so I'm working on it. But, you know, that's achievable. That's the result that Andy and I worked through. Trained in glorious detail. So this thing, where we have the determinant of the big metric, let's say tilde tilde, is going to be equal to the product of the determinant of HAB times, let's see, that would be that'd be the down one. And a determinant of minus H A B absolute value with the up one, A B C D Teflon, DF, H. So the volume forms, the Levy-Tudor tensor factors in bicontermal space. And notice that the determinant of HAB times the determinant of the inverse HAB is equal to the determinant of the product.
Basically one factor there.
What's that? That's probably N.
What?
Let's see, what is D squared? That's the trace of the identity, so that's just the dimension. I want the dimension.
Look in the diagonal, right?
What is that?
Is it just one in any dimension? Let's see. Well,
here, let's look at it this way. AC is the determinant of the product AC. That's the determinant of the identity. So a minus sign in here gives the minus one, but we're taking the absolute value. So this is just equal to epsilon ABCD, epsilon EFGH, no metric. The metric is dropped out. There is no factor here or here. That is one in bicontermal space. So the symplectic dual has no metric dependence. Right. The metric tensor has been replaced by the symplectic form, and the volume form is always one.
Are all of these determinant one, even in the other with the other G's? Let's see.
Yeah, the determinant invariant.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Right.
You get the same.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. Sure.
I have a question. To what? When it's curved. So like this is.
Flat,
right.
Flat conformal
space. Does that still happen when you have curved bicontermal space?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is flat.
Because that's, if it's flat, it doesn't matter that there's a G anyways, right?
Yeah. This happens anyway.
Okay.
For sure, locally. You could, I suppose, run into topological obstruction to the submanifold structure. So there's that question. But any curved bi-conformal space that's a deformation of the flat one, without cutting and pasting, is going to have the same problem.
Okay.
Because the metrics on the submanifold have got to, one's got to be minus the other.
Okay.
It's got to be traceless.
Okay.
And the symplectic structure in all of the biconformal spaces we've ever studied, we find that there is a symplectic form. So that they are all symplectic manifolds.
Okay.
So there's nothing in this argument that really cares about whether it's curved or flat.
I haven't seen curved bicontermal space yet. So what does H look like? Is H still a ones and zeros and negative ones?
The solution we've got. One of these spaces goes flat. Let's see, why is that? But then that's independent of the exact form of the metric. You can always do it in the ortho normal plane. You know, that's always done in perturbed cases. You write an ortho normal basis here, and you've got half your omegas up and half your omegas down. So you can always separate those unambiguously.
Mm-hmm.
And so each set of these spans some subspace. Now, whether that subspace is a manifold or not depends on the torsion and co-torsion tensors. Well, we generally take the torsion to be zero, so the power form always spans the manifold. That's always an inclusion. The co-solder form is in involution, basically is an only of the Einstein equation. So when you get general relativity is the condition that both of these are in. Okay, so now what? Alright, so this gives us a really nice dual. And we should probably, take the dual of something and see what happens. But some unexpected things came out. One thing of note is that the symplectic form, okay, so sigma AB, omega AB, say dxA, which dxB, but it turns out to be the exterior derivative of the vial vector, which is equal to omega A up, which omega A down. And as I mentioned last time, right, this equation is what tells us that this is a symplectic form, because that's manifestly closed and that's manifestly non-degenerate. Those are the conditions you need. So that in biconformal space, not in other conformal case theories, but in biconformal space, the dilatation equation always gives you a symplectic form. Now, if you do the what people are calling conformal gravity these days, which is the field theory gauging, you still have an equation that looks like this, but you don't have non-degeneracy because the co-solder form is a linear combination of the solder form, because you're only in four dimensions. You're in half the dimension. So these eight basis forms are not independent. And that object is likely degenerate. So you don't get a symplectic manifold in those series. Well, this particular form means that the components of omega are going to be, all right, it's anti-symmetric. So let's see, this is rho and that column, column, I'm going to have a Kronecker up here and minus a Kronecker down there and zero here. So in an orthonormal basis, the symplectic form takes this anti-symmetric octagonal Kronecker form. That's the Darboux form. That's the canonical form for a symplectic form.
Even if you raise both indices, you get the same thing. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, omega with both indices up, we can take the inverse of this, and this thing is, its inverse is minus this.
Oh, okay.
Minus minus.
Change the sign. Okay.
So, essentially the same thing. We have omega A up. Just put the minus sign up here. Okay.
Switched to the minus signs, or they're both minus
signs?
No, one. Too many minus signs. Suddenly that's becoming metric. There we go. That makes it funny in here, because what you get, what forms, basis forms you get out there, are going to match what you had before. So if you have a down index here, and you have an up down from the symplectic form, so it's going to sum onto an up index on the Levy Chitita, which is going to leave a down index tree. You know, we just need to work through one to see how this behaves. So let's pick a one form and find its dual. Let omega be, well, let's not call it omega.
Well, that's
a
just,
okay. Equal a down omega up and a b up and omega down, like that. So that's a general one form in biconformal space. And if we take the star of that, what do we take? We take the coefficient. We contract with the symplectic form. So we're going to contract with an A here. Well, an A there means we're going to have a B down here. And then we have the Levy Chitita. And since this sum's on the first index of Levy Chitita, so I need a B up. And then I can write these remaining ones in whatever order I'd like. Since they're contracted on forms, I can rearrange these, and I rearrange the forms, and the signs all cancel. So it doesn't matter what order, so I'm just going to choose CDE, and then I'll have omega C wedge omega D wedge omega E, and then I have the down ones, F, G, H, I, omega F. And very quickly, you find it's convenient to write GHI without writing all those silly omegas. So here I'm defining omega FGHI is defined as omega F wedge omega T wedge omega H wedge omega I. And similarly for down one. So just stringing the indices out is a lot easier than writing all those omegas all the time. It's akin to not writing the wedges. Okay, so now, let's see, what is that? Let's compute the divergence. Right, see what the divergence looks like here. So I could take an exterior derivative of the dual of one form, and what does that do? Well, this is just a chronicer. So that turns that A into a B, and so this is just summed on that F going up. So I have some 7 form here. So I'm going to have the derivative of that coefficient A. Oh, I forgot the B term. Sorry.
Oops.
Sorry. We're only halfway. We have a B with an A up. I forgot the normalization, too.
Ah! Oh, it's 1 over something. Sorry.
Yeah, well, it's 2 1 over something. Right. I think I mentioned this last time, but right, the normalization of an 8-index sum, or here, you know, we just count the number of indices and divide by n minus p factorial. But there's, if we have this convention where we separate these indices and factor the thing, then we're always summing the up ones here on some down ones there, and the down ones here on some up ones there. We don't have 8 factorial choices for how to do that. We have 4 factorial squares. So instead of dividing by 8 factorial, we're going to divide by 4 factorial and 4 factorial. And in terms like this, we're going to need, here we have it, we need a 3 factorial, and for this one, you need a 4 factorial. So you treat each of those separately.
So do I have to change this definition over here, or is that still good? N minus 2 factorial?
This will become a product. This becomes a product of 2 things. So, let's see. So our definition, I'll rewrite the definition. Let's finish this
okay.
Here. Then we'll okay. So now we're going to have an omega, but it's going to be the other component, an AB. And then supposed to write the B down first. So we have a B, and now what do we do with the rest? Well, like I say, it doesn't matter. I can write C, D, E, F, G, H, I, and then I'm going to have omega C, D, E, F, of which omega G, H, I, and a 1 over 3 factorial, 1 over 4 factorial. But now I'm obliged to reorder those. So this is the Kronecker delta, so I get A sub A, F1 A, or, yeah, A, C, D, E. Then I have omega C, D, E. And then this thing, it's convenient to define by, let's put a 4 up to mean a normalized volume form, omega F, G, H, I. So the 4 here goes up to indicate that it's solid form. we can write a corresponding thing with the 4 down for the cosolar form. Like that. Okay, so what I see here is that epsilon omega over 4 factorial can just be written as a full solder form volume form. Then for B, right, first off, I get a minus sign because the symplectic form of the lower left, oh, okay, the upper right, I guess the A should have had it. Right, the AB on the inverse solder form, the minus sign is up here. So we get a minus sign from that one.
How do you know? How do you know which one of those to use? AB down or AB?
It's the inverse. Look back to here. It's the inverse. Just like it's the inverse metric.
Okay. When it's both up or both down, is it
zero?
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Good. That's what I want to do.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's
okay.
Exactly, right there.
Okay, so when it really is, so when there's an A up and a B, a little A and a little B up, or a little A and a little B down, those are the zero components. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
right. Good thing, too. Because you have a lot of terms here. Okay, and then the B term. So we have a BA, and then this B. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to move this B over with the GHI. Well, I have to pass 4 things, so I don't get a sign in this case. So I'm going to have epsilon A GHI omega GHI. Now, that means I've got to move these 3 past those 4. No problem, because there are 4 of these. So even number, I don't get a sign. And then, let's see, what have I lost? Let me give myself a little more space here. Equals minus 1 over 3 factorial. I lost the 3 factorial. Here we have 1 over 3 factorial still here. GHI, and then we have a volume form of what kind? Well, these are the down guys, so I'm going to put up 4 volumes there to indicate that it's cosolar that has the complete volume. Okay, so there's the dual of a 1 form. Let's follow up one suggestion and rewrite our definition here. What did we have to fix? Let's see. what was it we needed to change?
The factorial.
No. Oh, the factorial.
Right.
Ah, okay. So,
normalization.
So, yeah, now, let me write this as, let's suppose that this is a P Q type, meaning P up and Q down.
N minus P times N minus Q.
So, that's right. Let's track it through. Because, if we've got P up, then we get some chronickers here. We're going to get P chronickers. There's still P up, and they're going to sum on P down indices here. So I'm going to need N minus P solder forms. So I'm going to need the XE through the X. Let me give myself more indices. F, G, H, D, X, E, through D, X, F, which D, Y, D, through D, Y, H, where an index on a Y is really down.
Right.
The capital index up on a Y is a flatten down, lowercase down. So what I wanted to do is count these. And, so we have P up here, so they're being summed down here. So the number of down ones is reduced by P, so that's going to be N minus P. And there will be N minus Q above. So, yes, we divide by N minus P factorial, N minus Q factorial. And let's see, what do we end up with? So, so if omega is a P Q type thing, then what kind of thing is star omega? Well, it's going to be an N minus P and an N minus Q. Like that. So we're getting the right sort of duality. But it's funny, because it's a duality within the subspace.
Right, you're not going into a different space.
So a DX type thing, it's going to end up with three dx's. Let's work through. Let's get this out of the way. Let's take d of star of omega. Let's continue. Let's find the divergence. So star d star, the boundary operator. It's not the same thing as it is with Hodge. For Hodge, we would get the divergence of the set, just the ordinary divergence. But here, we need to take d of all of that. So 1 over 3 factorial. Then we have a partial of A, so what I write is A, with respect to X, no B indices, so let's do a B here. And that's gonna give me an omega up. But look what happens. The omega ups are already saturated. So I get zero. I can't differentiate in X space without killing them. So I can take a dy derivative, all right, which I'll denote with a d up, and then I have the rest of that, epsilon A, C, D, E. And this brings in a Cosada form, omega D. And then I have omega D, D, D. So I've filled out that epsilon, except that there's a factorial difference. And then for B, yeah, 1 over 3 factorial. What can happen? Right here, I can't take a y derivative without having too many cosine forms. So I can only take an x derivative here. And so I'm going to end up with partial x is the free of dA. And then what happens? I'm going to have an omega B in front of all that. So epsilon AGHI. And omega B for that one. And then we get a GHI.
Those both have.
Yeah. And then 5-4. This one's got a where should I think it else to get in here? It's even. So I can stick it on that side. Okay, so that's the starting star.
Starting star.
Oh no, that's a B star. Now I want to take a starting star.
That's a A, right?
That's what?
You wrote omega, but that's an A. Over here. It's the, continuation of this example over here.
A. Yeah. Too many omegas.
So,
yeah.
Are we adding another form? Oh, I see. Yeah, we are. Okay. Never mind.
Yeah. So if our original A had been like a 2 form, then we would have ended up with 4 terms here from all the derivatives. You know, then we might have been able to take both x and y derivatives here. And I'm glossing over one point that I should make clear. These derivatives should be in coordinates, not, you know, you can define an orthonormal derivative, but you just have to use the inverse components of the solder or co-solder form. You know, if these were coordinate differentials, then that would just be the coordinate derivative. But what I mean by dd is really I need a d with respect to a coordinate times an omega ub. It's really something like that. So you need that matrix in there to allow you to write that. But with that understanding, then.
Otherwise, it had to be like a dB, dxB or something, or dyB.
Well, this is a dDy.
Right, right.
If I had an x derivative, I would write it this way, with the cosine. Let's call these two. This is an inverse solder form. This is an inverse cosine form. And unfortunately, in curved spaces, it's just not. If the submanifolds aren't orthogonal, it's not that simple. Because what you really have is, if you truly want something with a B index here, you also need the inverse of there'd be a mu B. There could be diagonal, block diagonal pieces of the solder and co-solder form. So you could have an x piece to the co-solder derivative. And similarly, you could have in a general space. So these guys are the inverse matrices to the solder and the solder and co-solder. Is that right? No, co-solder and solder. Yeah, so this is D these are components of the inverse to the cosine form. These are components to the inverse of the solder form. So I've done a, I could have an A down, U down in that inverse. So,
so we're taking D, we're actually using both of those derivatives, right? The DB up and the D.
Yeah,
down.
Okay. An exterior derivative is the usual exterior derivative. You differentiate with respect to everything. So you do both X and Y derivatives. So if you're using D, it's really easier to write. You know, it's working coordinates.
I didn't know that. The exterior derivative could be written in terms of these. Is that something new or is that in general? Or?
Let's see. Andre and I sorted that out.
Okay, because we don't use it in the regular.
I just don't know if we've written it up in the papers. We've published like 5% of what we've done. If you're taking exterior derivatives and you're working in an orthonormal frame, you have to do something like this. And if you've got this dual orthonormal frame, then you really end up needing both parts. Because in general, say the solder form, so I'm saying this is the inverse solder form, because look, the A is down, and I'm converting from a coordinate basis to an orthonormal basis here. But the components of the solder form, in general, it's a form, omega mu A dx mu plus omega mu A dy mu. All right? If I confirm a space, it's going to look like this in general. And then the cosolder is going to have the A down, but it'll also have an expression like this. Well, then the inverse component, so, this gives you some matrix, right, where, you've got, where the full solder form is some omega capital A that we know is an omega A up and an omega down, right? So if I want the form, the component of, middle of the alphabet coordinate, beginning of the alphabet is orthonormal, so dxm, what is this? This is omega mu A dx mu plus omega mu up A dy mu. And there are actually two of these. So what we really have is a matrix where we have omega mu A up omega, which way is row and column here? I guess I've written it row here. So mu A. Yeah, that'll work. And then here I have the cosolder component, mu A down, omega mu up A down. This acts on dx mu dy mu, that works, to give the full eight-dimensional solder form. And these omega tildes are the inverse matrix of this thing. Right, so you can invert these and have omega, let me call it tilde, M. The inverse matrix to that, well, whatever it is, there's some formula you can use. And, I remember Andre finding that formula. It's cool. He's got all these inverses of those. It's ugly. that's what you need if you're going to do this in an orthonormal frame, but then take D of something, you've got to do that with coordinates. Now, happily, it's often the case that one of those four omegas in the big matrix is zero. And that simplifies things a lot. That doesn't make the flaps down. It's not too hard. In the UV coordinate, that's your deep block diagonal. So we really kind of have, you know, a pizza for everyone. Whoever finds the steak in those coordinates first. I was checking that the UV expression satisfy the pressure equations and they go wrong. So there's a mistake in that paper on the website. I'm not sure what it is. It looks like, you know, maybe a missing factor of H or some fine drum, something like that. It should work. It's just a word of transformation. So we've run out of time. Blast. So, exercise, you know, take star of that thing. And, okay, star of that thing is going to be a scalar. And I say the odds are, 80-20 that you're going to come out with a funny spine in your diversion. It's going to be the difference. I'm pretty sure it's correct that the answer is star D star of A is going to be minus DAAA plus DABA with a minus sign. So you get different structures happening. The Poincaré lemma still holds, that's the truth. But things are subtly different, and you get to the field equations, you're solving a very different kind of field equation when you are working with a complex dual. And you can still do four-dimensional U1 gate theory with it. And it looks rather cool. So we'll start on with it. One or the other thing on Friday.